Italy has some of Europe's best renewable resources, but policy barriers and grid design risk targets not being met. To unpack these challenges, I'm joined by Patrizio Donati, co-founder and director at Terawatt, a Rome-based renewable energy independent power producer, to explore what's holding back renewables in Italy, how investors are managing risk, and what regulators could do to unlock the next wave of projects. I'm Yusuf Latif, and this is the Energy Transitions Podcast. Market forces are pushing renewables, but policy and grid design are lagging. What are the consequences of this, and how do we reconcile the two?
Okay, well, first of all, thank you very much for having me. The interesting point about this is that actually these are sequential, right? In theory, you should first of all have policy, then you should have grid design, and then you should have the resultant market forces that bring out the deployment of renewables. The reality is that actually in Italy, we're kind of in reverse, right? Where there's market forces pushing this renewable deployment, and then we're trying to catch up with the grid design and especially policy. This is because Italy has been behind the curve on the global renewable deployment. And in fact, I would say is the last frontier country left in Western Europe in which there still is the capacity to have real growth in the sector, because we're actually way behind partners such as Spain or France or Germany or the UK. That's why there's so much interest in the country, because all of these investors who maybe have already invested in Spain and now have no more space to grow are moving into Italy, right? Whether also it's the provision of services or like suppliers or whatever element of the market that has kind of slowed down in other parts of the world are now trying to move to, in other parts of Europe in particular, are now trying to move to Italy. The problem is that our policy is lagging in the sense that it's clear that there's a regulatory framework that is not conducive to a rapid deployment of renewables, especially in line with our 2030 targets. The grid, unfortunately, is very simply just a bottleneck, because the grid is not a liquid resource. We can't just, you know, snap our fingers and have, you know, more transmission lines. It takes a lot of time, a lot of planning. And in Italy especially, it's slowed down by what we call the Italy risk, right? Which is the regulation, the changing regulation, long bureaucracy times, many layers of approvals. Like it's a complicated picture. So the answer is very simply that we have to hope, and we're seeing now that the market forces win out over all of these other barriers, which in reality are just, they're not blocking barriers, they are simply delayers, right? So eventually these projects are going to come online. Eventually we're going to have these plants built, but it's just going to take a little bit more time than maybe many investors would like to, myself included, would like to see.
You mentioned there about what investors are really looking out for with these types of projects, and also how it's quite behind from other countries. It's neighboring countries, really. There's a recent report by Edison, and I think it's TIPA, about how I think it's 20% behind. What does this really mean for project bankability in the renewables sector for Italy?
So the fact that projects are behind means that we have higher power prices. The fact that we have higher power prices means that people want to invest, because obviously the returns can be higher. This is broad strokes. But then the projects are slow to develop. So then investors ask themselves, okay, do I really want to invest in a country where, yes, I can have a higher return, but I have to risk so much more capital because the projects are riskier to develop, because, you know, it takes more time. There's more approvals to get. It's all these different things. But then at the end, I have the benefit of having a higher power price, right? And especially in Italy, now we have the FER-X decree, which is a world-class support mechanism, which is a CFD for renewable energy production. And I think this really stimulates investors to want to come in. But unfortunately, we return to the issue of the market but the regulatory forces, which create this break. So again, the issue is that these projects will come online at some point. They will be deploying their energy into the grid. We're just gonna have to see how the regulatory landscape is going to evolve, and if hopefully the European directives will win out over local political pressures.
There's a lot happening in terms of the market. I know that in Italy there was recently the first battery auction. Mm-hmm. What does this kind of signal in terms of the renewables versus the storage landscape and how things are going to develop in the coming years?
Okay, so there's two answers to this. So the first side is kind of the history, and then the next is the future, let's say. So when we first started developing Just Solar in 2022, we started getting a few requests from funds about batteries, and they were like, okay, you know, we'd like to look into this because it was already big in countries like the UK, which is much more advanced in this kind of rollout. And it wasn't really talked about in Italy, right? And there was a time when there was so much investor hype over batteries in Italy that you could sell a project which had only had contracted land, right? And that means that you haven't even started the grid connection process, but already if you said, I have a piece of land that I'm contracting on which I will develop, you could already get an investor to buy that project, right? So they were willing to buy nothing because there was the promise of the Maxi auction, right? And the Maxi auction essentially was going to give basically an availability payment to battery owners from the grid. And so there has been such a glut of projects in the market, which actually did end up getting developed, surprisingly, because I thought there would be a higher mortality rate, that these auctions have gone oversubscribed. The bids came in much lower than people were expected. And I think, I don't remember exactly what the numbers were, but we've essentially come out at more or less half what the price was expected to be. And obviously, you know, if you have a project that works at a certain level of income, then at half that level of income, a lot of projects are going to struggle. And so now we're actually starting to see that I think we saw some operators actually give up their bid so that they rejected the participation. They said, we're just going to go and try and find a tolling agreement or just try and get some market-based revenues. And then others are instead now just saying, okay, well, we're going to have to make this work, but how can we make this work? So it's a very interesting time right now for the battery market. In the future, however, I am 100% certain that batteries are going to become a completely integral part of the grid because we're very simply shifting away from the traditional form of energy generation, which is demand-driven, right? And now we're shifting into supply-driven generation where, you know, the generation is going to occur regardless of demand. And the only way that we can balance this is by having storage to you know, essentially store the excess energy before it's needed, right? That's the only way. Otherwise, it just goes to waste and you end up with issues like curtailment, zero prices, negative prices, all of those things that we're seeing happen in other markets, which are causing serious problems to investors. As Terawatt specifically, all our new projects are now going to have co-located or dislocated storage.
Yes, I think storage comes up quite often when it's in terms of curtailment and offsetting that. It's obviously a huge kind of way to resolve that. But in terms, just going back to policy, I think if there was kind of one structural element of the renewables market that you could change overnight, what would that be?
Just one?
Go for it.
No, I mean,
more than one if there's a priority list.
There's quite a few. And I think this is a message that gets repeated over and over and over every time we speak about, experts in the sector come together to discuss what's going on. Renewables are purely a regulatory issue. Full stop. There is, we do not have supply chain bottlenecks yet. We might, you know, but maybe we do have a bottleneck in the sense that, you know, engineers are not a liquid resource. It takes many years to train them. And actually now the whole world is trying to make this transition. So actually it's quite difficult to compete for engineering talent. So that's one bottleneck. But otherwise, you know, you can find panels very cheaply now. I'd like to remind everyone that in 2022, we were looking at 30 cents per watt. And now I'm buying panels at less than 10. Right. So
wow.
That's a big drop in price. The support structures or trackers are actually quite simple now, and it's quite a solved problem. It's basically just poles driven into the ground, very minimal civil works in order to get them in. And, you know, there's a little bit more of the technical side to the wind farms, but even there, it's quite standardized now. Again, it's the civil works that are a bit more complicated. So there isn't really a big technical challenge that we're trying to solve here. And in fact, most of our engineering work comes from creating all of the reports and all of the studies and all of the impact assessments and all of the various approval studies that we need to make to get the approval to build there. You know, when in reality, it took us maybe 2 years to approve a 1 megawatt solar farm, and it's going to take us less than 3 months to build it. right? So that tells you that there's a big issue in terms of getting those approvals and those permits and getting everything lined up, rather than actually just getting these projects on the ground. I did a little research, which I found actually quite interesting. So, I mean, China installed an insane amount of gigawatts. I want to say something like 250, something like that this year. Italy is on track to installing 7, right, in 2025. Mm-hmm. Maybe a little bit more. It was 7 in 2024. I think it's a bit more now, but still it's a much smaller amount. Obviously, you know, you might say, but, you know, that China is a much bigger country. They have way more population. And so it makes sense that we would install much less. But on a per capita basis, essentially it comes down to Italy has installed 100 watts per person and China has installed 300. Right. So that tells you even on a per capita adjusted basis, they are installing much more than Italy is. And it's purely down to regulation because they can just go in and they don't have to get all the various layers of approval or in the same way, at least that we do. And it doesn't take them nowhere near the same amount of time. One sort of anecdote that I like to tell is about one project that we were getting permitted where we were asked. I mean, it's a 6 months of back and forth of emails with the local authority who was giving us this permit. They said, okay, you need to give us a sound impact assessment, right? And we said, and this is, by the way, not like this. This was letters, write, and then sign, approve, wait 3 weeks for an answer. And yeah. And so they say, yes, give us a sound impact assessment. We say, okay, formally we reply, okay, once the project is built, we'll go there and we'll do the assessment. They said, no. You have to give us a sound impact assessment before the project is built. And so essentially the what ended up happening was that we had to send an engineer out with a recorder on an empty field to record the background noise and certify that the solar farm was not going to be breaching European sound levels or whatever, which, by the way, is already implied by the certification of the inverters and the panels and everything that it's not that it's compliant with these regulations. And then they didn't accept our report because the report didn't state that the solar farm would not make noise at night.
Oh, wow.
So you see, these are some of the issues this is a funny story. And like, you know, I really like telling it, but these are delays.
Yeah.
This is extra time. You know, this was 3 months. 3 months of debate and 10,000 euros of cost for us as a developer to try to answer these requests, which, you know, you don't really have recourse against the public body that is asking you these things, because then, yes, okay, it could take me 3 months to give you what you want, or I could take you to court and it could take 6-12 months to get that court decision. So, you know, for speed, we just have to go with it, essentially. So I hope that answered the question.
Yeah, no, yeah. It more so. I want to talk a bit about your experience from a corporate finance background now into the IPP field. How has this almost informed your approach to capital allocation and risk management? How has it evolved?
Okay, I think the best way to answer this is that when you work in sort of a more corporate environment, you live and die by the spreadsheet. The spreadsheet is king, and you know, we spend all of this effort calculating whether, you know, the discount rate is 6 or 6.01 and this huge changes in valuation that then loads of people spend time debating. And the reality on the ground is very, very different, right? Because all of these things are kind of discussions that you can have when you're part of a very, very big structured entity, and especially when you're trying to make a decision between different types of investments. But when you're instead a small developer, the reality on the ground is way more rustic, let's say, right? So, I mean, you consider risk much more on a cash basis rather than on a returns basis in terms of saying, you know, like I have however many thousands, hundreds of thousands or millions that I'm able to invest. And you try to understand, okay, so then how can I manage this from a cash flow perspective much more tightly? And the reality also is that, you know, maybe you might do some reasonings when you're in this sort of corporate finance environment, especially if you're in I was in London beforehand, which is a completely different market, where you say, you know, okay, you might say, I have signed a contract with this supplier who is going to provide this service over the next 6 months, and you model that out. The reality on the ground, especially in Italy, is that, okay, you sign this contract, the likelihood that that is actually going to play out as you forecasted is, I would say, less than 50%, right? Because, I mean, I can't even tell you the amount of times that we've had, you know, engineers who have delivered late, who have not delivered, who have made mistakes that they shouldn't have, and, you know, all these different things, which just in my previous life just weren't happening. So it's informed a very different perspective on what risk really is and how to manage it, I'll say.
Based on that, what kind of advice would you give to other IPPs who perhaps don't really come from that kind of background?
You mean moving into Italy?
Yeah.
Well, what I would say is that working in Italy is working in a very specific market. I think that there is a very different approach to the world of work than you might find, for instance, in Northern Europe. And this is something that I've noticed personally. There's a lot more of an emphasis on personal relationships. And there's a lot more of, let's say, I would say in general, like the level of professionality is not as high in Italy, but simply because, I mean, my theory at least is that we just don't have the same corporate culture that you might have in somewhere like the UK, right? So, I mean, I think most employers in the UK will be large corporates, most people in the UK will be employed by large corporates, or someone working for a large corporate or in that ecosystem. Whereas in Italy, it's basically all small, medium, family-owned enterprises, right? The other thing is that because the development process is so difficult to manage in terms of the various layers of approval and the amount of bureaucracy that you need to get through. Like, I mean, one of the other anecdotes that I like to tell is the fact that every time I submit a document to a public authority, I not only have to give them that document, I also have to sign a piece of paper that says what is written in this document is true. Right?
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's only that I have to sign it. If I engaged an external provider, they also have to sign it.
So paper stacks.
It's just like it's an insane amount of excess bureaucracy. I have another little anecdote that I quite like telling is the fact that I request a grid connection from Enel. Once my project is and I give them certain information. Once my project is approved, I have to go and register my project on my farm on the Gaudi portal of Terna, which is essentially a portal to manage all of the energy generating projects in Italy, right? And when I go to register on Gaudi and Terna, I have to give them the same information that I gave Enel in the grid connection, when I requested the grid connection at the beginning, right? And then if I make a mistake in writing down that information, it's not that they say, okay, you know, I'll reach out to Enel. They tell me, no, you made a mistake, and I have to reach out to Enel to just simply input again the information that I already gave in the beginning.
It's not a small amount of information.
A small amount of information. We're talking about all the, like, inverter design, the single line diagrams, the power that's being put in, the production that's coming out, all these different elements. When really, so I find this very funny because it's that they know that my answer is wrong, but then I have to go to them to get that answer, then come back and hand it in to the right-hand side, to this other side, which is quite entertaining.
Considering all of that, mm-hmm. What advice do you think you'd give to European regulators to facilitate the next generation of IPPs, arguably in a more efficient manner?
I think it's very simple. There needs to be a single European standard by which projects get evaluated and permitted. Full stop. A single platform where a developer can go and can say, okay, I want to produce a solar farm on this plot of land, and these are the feasibility studies, these are the constraint studies, this is the electrical design. And it's all very, very standard, right? It's not like no one's inventing anything new here. We're simply saying, this is the technology that I'm using, this is the area where I'm putting it. Am I allowed to proceed or not, right? 90% of the, let's say, the work that we have to do is simply managing the communication of this information, which is the same information every time, to different bodies, you know, because we have to give some of the information to the grid operator, some information to the transmission operator, some information to the council, some information to the region, some information to the state, and it's all replicated over and over again every time. A single digital platform would be so easy, right? Especially because What we could also hypothesize, which I think would be the correct thing, is that rather than me having to prove that I can build a solar farm there, there should already be, I think, a European-level database or even a national database where you have, okay, this is where you can build and this is where you can't. Full stop, right? Because if the nation already knows, or if the local authority already knows where I can and can't build because that's what the constraints say, then why do I need to prove to you that I can do that? You know it already, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In an ideal world where that is no longer a bottleneck, let's say, what do you think the next bottleneck would be, or would there be none?
No, there definitely would not be none. I think there's a few issues which are going to start becoming more and more prevalent over the coming years. The first one, as we mentioned before, is the grid. The grid is a non-liquid resource. And even if, let's say, that you could snap your fingers and build that high voltage transmission line wherever you wanted, unfortunately, it still takes time and resources to build. And so there's always going to be a little bit of that gap, or even a lot of that gap and delay between that. And also it needs to be planned and maintained correctly, right? So knowing that actually in that area, you need that high voltage transmission line rather than somewhere else. And so that's going to be, I think, the next big thing that's going to come up. And then the next, I think, layer, which we're not there yet, but I think we'll get there, is that we're going to have to start making some serious decisions about land use. Because land is a finite resource, and it's not just used. I mean, there was a European-level study that basically showed that we can do all of our 2030 targets by having less than 2% of European farmland or European available land. So you might say that, okay, well, the problem doesn't really present itself, but, you know, it's not like you have farming and then renewable or energy generation. You have farming, you have energy generation, you have industry, you have residential developments, you have roads, you have bridges, you have whatever else it is that you might, you have forestry, you know, you have conservation. And the more we kind of expand as a society, the more we need to be as efficient as possible with this use of land. So that's going to be the next very interesting question, which is that how do we actually optimize not only on a project level but on a societal level the use of these limited parcels of land.
Patricio, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your insights.
Thank you for having me.
For more insights, join the Inlet community.